We'll explain all of this here in a second, but the journalist Maria Konnikova had a plan to learn something about the interplay between chance and skill. That is, how much of the success we have in our lives is our own doing, and how much is just dumb luck? You know, how often are we actually in control, and how does that perception of being in control, how does that play out in the decisions we make? And the way she decided to learn about that was by playing high-stakes competitive poker. She tells the story in a new book, how she was going to take a year, learn how to play, and then get into the World Series of Poker in Vegas. It didn't quite work out that neatly, but she gets a coach, a master poker player, who tells her that before she actually can go to Vegas or anywhere to play live, she has to start on her computer.
I live in New York, and online poker is not legal in New York. So I found myself every single day doing a very strange sort of reverse commute. I would take the PATH train to New Jersey. I'd plop myself in a cafe and I'd play. And the rationale behind this was online, you get so much more experience so much more quickly. And you really get to see what poker is like over thousands and thousands of hands. And live, it would take years in order to get that sort of experience. So here I am sitting in Starbucks, and I hadn't had much success up to this point, but I'd already played with some of these people. And the beauty of online poker is that you can actually tag people. So you get to take notes on them on your computer screen. And then if you ever play with that person again, the little note that you've tagged them with pops up along with that player. And so here I am at a table, and all of a sudden a familiar player jumps in, and I don't remember him, to be perfectly honest, but I have a note on him. So I click and I want to see what the note says. And the note says, aggressive idiot asshole. And that just told me everything that I needed to know. This was a guy who just loved to push me around. It was very clear that I was female, and I did that on purpose because as a psychologist, I was really interested in the dynamics of how men respond differently to women. And so my screen name was Psych Chick, and my avatar was this little puppy, something very soft and small, powerless. This guy had clearly not taken a liking to me, and every time we'd played before, he'd be insanely aggressive, like so aggressive that it was stupid, hence the idiot part. I smiled to myself. I said, okay, you know, I know how to play against this. And we got into a hand together where I ended up raising with a very strong hand. I had an ace and a king, which are one of the best starting hands. He re-raised me, and I decided, you know, I'm just going to call you because you're an aggressive idiot asshole. So I'm just going to let you be aggressive and I'll just be passive here. And I ended up flopping the absolute stone cold nuts, which is the poker term for the best hand that you can possibly have. An ace high flush. No one can beat you. So I decided to check, which means I'm not going to bet because, again, aggressive idiot asshole, I was going to let him be the bully for me. And so he started betting and betting and betting, and eventually he gave me all his chips, and he ended up giving me enough of a chip lead that I went on to win my first ever online poker tournament. This was one of the first times when I was successfully able to use what I'd observed about people and what I'd observed about them specifically in relation to me, how they interact with me, how they perceive me, when I was able to use that and flip it on its head and use it against someone. And I would very soon learn upon arriving in Vegas that live poker is not online poker, and that it can be much more difficult to control your emotions, control your reactions, just control everything when you're in the spotlight and everyone is actually looking at you and you're not hidden behind your computer screen. All of a sudden, emotions run hotter. It becomes more difficult to think clearly, and I definitely had a full battle ahead of me. But that particular evening, I was just so incredibly happy that I was able to get the better of this aggressive idiot.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're revisiting our conversation from last year with Maria Konnikova. We were talking about her book, The Biggest Bluff. As a psychologist, Konnikova had always been fascinated in the way humans make the decisions that we do and how it doesn't really make a lot of rational sense. We go with our gut when we shouldn't. We give ourselves more credit than we should. We think we're in control when we're just not. And it was all very theoretical for her until 2015, when it got personal. Her mother and then her husband lost their jobs. Her grandmother died suddenly. She developed this medical condition. And it made her realize in a very real way just how much of a role chance plays in life. So she wanted to learn more.
It just made me stop and reflect on just how much of our lives are governed by luck, by just pure chance, by things that we have no control over, and that you can work really hard and you can accomplish a lot and you can do your best, but sometimes you run up against the limits of where that brings you. And we just usually take our good luck for granted. We don't stop every day and say, oh, wow, you know, how lucky I am. And when you go through something like this, it makes you realize just how not necessarily unstable, but fragile everything can be, that you can work so hard and then get sick. And you can make all the right life choices. You know, I do yoga, I meditate, I eat well, I cook, you know, almost all of my own meals. Everything is very healthy. I do what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, sometimes your body just doesn't care. It's going to get sick and that's it. And sometimes you're going to slip in the night and hit your head and die, like my grandmother, even though you are totally healthy and living on your own and independent. And that will happen. And we should be so grateful when it doesn't, because that has nothing to do with us. It's just random noise and variance and just stuff of life that's out of our control. And that moment, I just thought, this is going to be my book. I want to write about this. I want to explore the role that chance plays in our lives. I want to learn how we can tell the difference between what is under our control and what isn't. You know, where does our skill end and where does luck begin?
What is it that interests you about that idea of separating the random from the intentional? Because you've been thinking about this a long time, and maybe mention how you explored this idea in grad school, in fact.
I've definitely been absolutely fascinated by control and the limits of control for a very long time. And I do think it has something to do with the fact that very early on in my life, I was put up against what it means to have absolutely no control, to not be able to make yourself known or understood. Because when we came to the United States, I didn't speak a word of English. And I remember, you know, I remember my first day of school, and I couldn't communicate. And it for a four-year-old to be in a position where you're just completely helpless is not something that we often experience, or actually, I guess a five-year-old if I was just starting kindergarten. But still, I remember it vividly. And I think the seeds were planted from an early age and from, you know, experiencing things like that. And also things like, wow, great luck, something you didn't control, but your parents came here. Look at the life that you can now lead. So it's definitely been in my mind. And then I actually decided to study it explicitly when I decided to get a PhD in psychology and went to graduate school. My advisor was one of the greatest psychologists of the 20th century. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that. Walter Mischel, who most people know as the marshmallow guy, the guy who created the famous marshmallow test of self-control. And originally, you know, I told him that I wanted to study self-control with him and decision-making and kind of emotional and risky decision-making. Now, when I went to grad school, this was 08. So it was right when the financial crisis was was happening and the markets were crashing and the financial system was crashing. And we were just kind of looking and saying, wow, you know, where does this end? What's going on? And so I designed my grad work to actually try to get at the psychological reasons behind what happened. And I wanted to know, you know, do people who are very high in self-control, who are good at controlling things, who are very skillful, did they keep this from getting worse? Were they kind of the ones keeping it from the brink of collapse? And it turned out that it was actually the exact opposite. That when you put very smart people who usually are so good at controlling things in a stochastic environment like the stock market, where things change rapidly and they're not in control, all of a sudden, they don't learn that well from what's going on. They don't learn that well from their experiences because they don't like the negative feedback. And they say, oh, no, no, I know what's going on. This is just noise. I'm just going to keep doing what I always do. And then the people who just had no idea, they were like, oh, I'm losing lots of money. I should probably do something about it. And they actually learned and they actually took negative feedback and ended up performing better, which was really shocking. And it was kind of the beginning of my interest in what I called the limits of control, because we found that people fell for what's known as the illusion of control. So you think you're still in control even when you're not. And it's a very, very powerful illusion. And it's one that causes us to make a lot of mistakes in our decision process. And so I'd been thinking about it, but something that I'd never been able to crack was, how do we make it better? How do we stop ourselves from falling for the illusion of control? How do you actually make better decisions? Because, you know, boy, am I good at uncovering the things we do wrong. So how do we fix it? And that's much more difficult.
Are our brains, the way we're wired, are we capable of comprehending uncertainty? Because one of the things you point out is that, you know, the first humans, they didn't have numbers or calculations. They just had anecdote. They just had experience. And it seems like that has stayed with us. Despite the probabilities and despite the numbers, we feel like we should go with our gut because it's all we have.
That's very true. So it turns out that human brains to this day remain really, really terrible at probabilistic thinking and at understanding what probabilities actually mean in real life. And when I say human beings, I include in that people who are statisticians, who study probabilities for a living, because there's a very big difference between understanding something theoretically and then being able to act on it practically. And you alluded to something, which is that when we were evolving, we learned through experiences, through anecdotes, through one-off events. And that's how our brain learns best. Not from what someone tells us about, you know, the base rates of this type of thing occurring in this environment, but about what happened to me, or what happened to my brother, or what happened to the person who has the cave next to mine. That's what we care about. And in psychology, this is known as the description experience gap, the gap between real probabilities, so what the real chances are, and what we think they are based on our gut, based on what we've actually experienced. And unfortunately, probabilities are not normally distributed. That means that probabilities don't look like we think they should look like based on theory. And so sometimes when, you know, you hear some sort of probability, but it's never happened to you and it feels very distant, you think, you know, it's basically 0%. I don't care about that. Doesn't matter. And if a probability isn't tiny, 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 but you personally have experienced it or know someone who has, all of a sudden has this outsized effect in your brain and you think it's much more likely than it actually is. And that's the way that we normally act. And that's the way we normally make decisions. But it's wrong because it doesn't actually have any bearing on the reality, on the real chances, on the real probabilities. And even someone, it's funny, I've talked multiple times about this to Daniel Kahneman, who has a Nobel Prize in economics, the only psychologist to win the Nobel Prize in economics. And he studies this. He studies these biases and he laughs that he still commits all of these errors. Knowing them doesn't make you suddenly immune. And to me, that's just the proof that, you know, we're all doomed in some sense. But as I learned, we can limit our doomedness. I'm gonna coin a new word here on air. Our doomedness can be mitigated a little bit through things like poker.
So when does poker occur to you? Because when you began all of this, you didn't know pretty much, you knew nothing about the game for the most part. You weren't even sure how many cards were in a deck.
Yes, I thought there were 54.
Right.
that is exactly what I thought. Now, so at the beginning, I didn't know what the book was going to be because chance is not a book. Chance is a philosophical inquiry into the meaning of life.
Yeah.
So I needed a topic. I needed to figure out, well, what's my way in? And I was reading, which is what I always do whenever I'm working on something new. And one of the things I was reading about was game theory, because it's not a far leap from chance to game theory.
Yeah.
Game theory is one of the most well-known frameworks for looking at these sorts of decisions. And I decided to look at the theory of games and economic behavior, which I'd never read. That's kind of the foundational text of game theory. And I learned that one of its authors and one of the fathers of game theory, John von Neumann, was a poker player, and that poker was actually the basis of game theory, that it was the inspiration for this entire thing. And von Neumann was an absolutely brilliant man, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. I mean, not just the father of game theory, but the father of the computer, one of the inventors of the hydrogen bomb. I mean, the guy was a genius.
Yeah.
And he wrote that poker was the game that was best suited to understand human strategic decision-making at the highest levels. He thought that the game of poker would actually help prevent nuclear war. And the way that he described it, he said that a game like chess doesn't interest him because it can be solved,
yeah,
because it's a game of perfect information. You know every single piece, you know every single square, and give me enough computing power, I can tell you the right answer. And to him, that was boring because that had no bearing on the reality of life, where a situation like that never arises, because in life, there's no such thing as perfect information. And that's what drew him to poker, because poker is a game of imperfect information, of having to make the best decision you can with the information you have, knowing that that information will necessarily never be complete. And knowing that your decision is probabilistic, that all you can do is put yourself in a position to get lucky, put yourself in a position to have the right outcome. But that doesn't mean that the outcome is certainly going to go in your direction. There's always that probability that it won't.
Mm.
And so you have to make a decision knowing all of that. And this really intrigued me. And that was actually my way into poker through John von Neumann. So I decided, he said, this is a great metaphor for life. This is a great way to look at decision making. And I said, okay, John von Neumann, I will trust your genius and I will look into this game of poker.
Right.
And he was right.
Yeah.
By God, he was right.
And your grandmother hated this idea.
Yes.
She was deeply disappointed in this idea that her granddaughter was going to play poker, which raises this idea of the misconceptions about poker, because you mentioned how the world of poker is laden with these misconceptions. And one of the big ones is, besides what I think your grandmother thought was that it just seemed like completely immoral because it was betting and there was money involved and all those kinds of things. But the big misconception you talk about is also how people equate poker with gambling.
Yes.
That you say there is an element of chance, of course, and it seems easy for a lot of people, but talk about this. Poker is a skill.
Yes.
In fact, I love this. You describe it as a back and forth interpretive dance.
So, yes, people do just think that, poker gambling, because poker's played in a casino.
Yeah.
And poker's played for money. And that makes something like chess a respectable game and something like poker just plain old gambling. And that's absolutely not true. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, how do I make this explanation as pithy as possible? So I came up with one sentence that explains why poker is a game of skill and not chance. And that's that in poker, you can win with the worst hand and you can lose with the best hand. And in no other game in a casino is that the case. You have to have the best hand to win, right? In blackjack, in any of these things, you win or you lose, and it's based on what happens. And that what happens, sure, you can increase your odds a little bit in blackjack, but at the end of the day, it's a game of chance. You have no way of affecting the outcome. The cards are just going to come the way that they're going to come. And roulette, all of these other things, you have to either win or not. In poker, you can have the best hand, but someone can outplay you and make you fold it. And all of a sudden they win. And that means that they were the more skilled player. And that's not possible anywhere else. And you can be that more skilled player where you have something that's terrible and somehow you convince everyone else to lay down their cards. And that's a wonderful feeling, knowing that your bluff has gotten through and that all of a sudden you're victorious. And not because the cards favored you, but because you knew how to play your opponents. You knew how to navigate the situation. You correctly read all of the signs. You made good decisions and you've been rewarded for it. To me, that's just the epitome of skill.
Maria Konnikova, her latest book is The Biggest Bluff: How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Utah has one of the highest suicide rates in the country. It's also a conservative, pro-gun state, and half of suicides here involve firearms. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Emily Means. This week on 45 Days, we're talking about how the legislature is trying to address the factors that contribute to our state's high suicide rate.
Listen to 45 Days for free wherever you listen to podcasts or go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're replaying our conversation from last year with Maria Konnikova, talking about her experience learning to play high-stakes competitive poker as a way of trying to explain just how much control we have over our lives and how much is just luck. The book is called The Biggest Bluff. Okay, so let's explain the plan that you laid out for yourself. And you mentioned it was pretty contained. It's really straightforward. You're going to spend a year doing this, all neat and controllable and digestible. Like that was the idea. But it gets really complicated. And I don't want to give too much away, but just explain how it does get complicated, because you mentioned how the plan starts to shift. And the way you encounter these complications are good lessons, the way you tell throughout the book. But you thought it would be the sort of neat, contained thing, and it just wasn't that at all.
And it's so funny, you know, I conceive of this book as a way to explore chance, and yet somehow I still convince myself that I'm going to be able to do yeah. a nice, neat little experiment that's yeah. going to last exactly 1 year
right.
and that's going to have a very specific starting and end point. Well, at first, you know, it shifted right away. So when I initially thought about doing this book, it was the summer and the World Series of Poker was exactly a year away. It's a year in the future. And I thought, oh, you know, the World Series of Poker, I've heard of that and I know nothing about poker. I'm going to play the main event, which is the biggest event in the poker world every single year. And I'm going to train for a year and then I'm going to play that event. And that's going to be the book. Great arc, great everything. You know, publishers loved it, you know, yeah. sold the book, everything's great. But time passes. So this is classic. If we just want to slap a little psychology into this, this is a classic planning fallacy right. where things take much longer than you think they're going to take. And so, you know, by the time I actually got started, it was, you know, already very late fall. And all of a sudden, the summer is not a year anymore. It's 9 months. And the first time I went to Vegas, it was already winter. And so all of a sudden, you know, the timeline is even more compressed. And this is the first time that I'm playing at a live event. And so things got complicated that way right away. And, you know, the normal thing would be, okay, well, if I still want it to be a year, what's next winter? You know, what do I do then? Can I have a different endpoint? Or why a year? You know, why don't I make it, you know, a year and a half or whatever it is to get me to the next World Series? But it's very hard to actually think that way when you're in something. And instead you just, you have this bias where you're going to just keep going. You know, so many biases, status quo bias, sunk cost fallacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can just rattle off all the things that go on in your mind that make it very, very difficult to swerve, because you think that it's going to be a blow to your reputation, that you're going to be, you know, letting yourself down or letting someone else down. And so you keep going. And all of a sudden, all of these things are not falling into place and you keep going. And by the time I got to the main event, not only had it not been a year, but I knew on some level that I wasn't ready. And the reason I realized that was that I didn't consult with my coach, Eric Seidel, on whether or not I should play, because in the back of my mind, I must have known he'd say no.
Yeah.
And I was too committed to this already. So I didn't even ask his opinion. I just signed up to play. And this isn't quite a spoiler alert since my book starts with it. I ended up getting a migraine as well. Yeah. During this competition, and the morning of, I already knew I was going to get a migraine because I've suffered from migraines my whole life and I can see all the warning signs, and I just chose to ignore them because this time it wasn't convenience. So I decided I wasn't getting a migraine and that I was wrong and went to play anyway. And spoiler alert, it did not go well.
Right. Well, let's talk about Eric. He's a really important character in the story. You had a lot of options for people, but you chose him for a guide into this world, someone to take you on as a student. I mean, you had to talk him into it, but he was willing to. So what was it about Eric that made you want him as this guide? He's quiet, he's reserved, he's attentive, but he's been good, and he's been good for a long time.
He has. And this is definitely one of the things that drew me to him, was his longevity. Poker tends to be a young man's game. And by the way, I say man on purpose, yeah. Not because I'm being gendered, but because poker is 98% male, which is insane. So it's a young man's game. I hope that one day it will also be just a young person's game, no matter who you are. But these days it's a young man's game. It takes a lot of athleticism because you are sitting for hours and hours and hours, 12, 13, 14 hours a day. So you have to be able to do that. And it's easier to do that when you're younger. And it evolves very quickly. So you have to constantly work and constantly be willing to travel and all of these things that mean that most people burn out pretty quickly. And it's very rare to find someone who's able to have success for multiple decades. And Eric stood out to me because he'd been around since the 80s and he was still, I mean, to this day, 2020, he is still winning tournaments and winning at the highest levels and playing at the highest levels. And there was no one else like that. What I didn't know about him was actually everything that made him such a phenomenal human being, because he is a very private person and there's not a lot about him online, but I had no idea that he loved theater and loved music and loved restaurants and just had such a rich life, but he did. And so it ended up just being someone who wasn't a poker coach so much as a life mentor.
I kind of thought that his affection for jazz was a clue to the way he plays and the way he thinks about it, because it seems like that was one of the lessons you learned was, I'm not sure if it's improvisation as much as just being able to react to the moment and to pay attention. That was, I think you said, the first lesson you got from Eric.
Yeah, I think that's very smartly observed by you. The fact that he does love jazz is the way he plays. And it is improvisation, but good improvisation. Yeah. And good improvisation comes from what the other musicians are doing. You're able to listen to them and you're able to respond and you're able to play differently when you're playing with different groups and you're playing and you're able to change the way you play when someone else changes the way they play. So it's constantly observing, constantly reacting, and constantly being able to go with the flow. And that's what good poker is. That's what good decision making is. It's paying attention to other people. It's paying attention to the nuances of what they're doing. And it's playing differently depending on who's at your table. You can't have one style. You can't have one approach. You have to be able to change. You have to be able to grow. And in order to do that, you need to be fully present, fully attentive, and fully in the moment, which is really difficult to do. I didn't fully grasp how difficult until I was sitting at a poker table for, 10-hour stretches. Yeah. And I really, really, really wanted to look at my phone. And Erica told me I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something the great poker player and teacher Phil Galfond told you. Mm-hmm. He said that the most important part of poker is storytelling. He said poker is a narrative puzzle. What did he mean?
Phil Galfond has a wonderful way with words, and he knew that I was a writer. So he was trying to figure out, okay, how do I explain this game to her in a way that she'll understand? And he came up with this absolutely beautiful way of describing it. And it was exactly this, that poker is a story, and you're a storyteller, and everyone else at the table is a storyteller. And your goal is not just to tell the most compelling story you possibly can, but to listen to everyone else's stories and pick them apart. Figure out, do they make sense or do they not make sense? Where are the logical inconsistencies? And if you think about what a story is not just A and B narrative, it's also characters and motivations. Why is someone doing something? And what would a person like this be likely to do in a situation like this? That's how you tell a story that's compelling. That's how you tell a story that's motivated. That's what you constantly have to think about when you're trying to figure out whether stories make sense. Why? And Phil said something that just made me laugh, but it's true. I've seen him play and it's absolutely true. He said, sometimes I know how my opponent would play the hand better than they know it. And so I know that their story doesn't make any sense because he's been observing them for so long that he knows what the story's supposed to be like if they actually had the hand that they're representing. Because everything that you're doing is telling a story. You're telling a story about how strong you are, about how strong your cards are, how strong your hand is, how confident you are. And no one knows what your cards are. All they know is the story that you're telling and the way that you're acting. And so your goal is to kind of be a story detective and to figure out, does this story pass muster or not?
It made me think of actors, who they go through a similar kind of process, at least the good ones. They, in order for them to do this thing, they have to know why they're doing it. They have to understand their motivation. That's part of their process. And I guess you extend that to life as well. Like we have to construct this kind of story arc for certain situations in our life.
Yes, that's absolutely right. One of the most powerful lessons that Phil gifted me wasn't just this thing, always ask why, but the notion that I was going to have to explain to him why I was doing something, because that forced me to actually ask why. It's one thing to say, okay, yeah, I'll ask why I'm doing something. But if you're about to act and you say, wait, what am I going to tell Phil? And if your answer is, well, it just feels right. Bad answer. That's not a good reason. Yep. Well, because I think I'm supposed to do this. Nope. Bad answer. And so all of a sudden you say, well, then why am I doing this? And if the answer is, I don't know, then maybe don't do it. maybe don't actually act that way. And imagine how many mistakes we'd avoid in our decisions in day-to-day life if just before we acted, we always paused and we always stopped and asked why. Why are we doing this? And why are we doing this and not that?
Right.
Why are we actually choosing this specific course of action? Would that one be better? It's this sort of mental calculus that sounds like it takes forever to do, but it doesn't. This is all fractions of seconds because your brain thinks quickly. And this is all you just taking that time, taking a breath, taking a pause before plunging and realizing that sometimes those seconds, that's not wasted time. That's some of the most valuable time that you can have. And the most powerful way that you can spend it is in just thinking and reflecting before you take that leap.
Maria Konnikova, her book is The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and psychologist Maria Konnikova. We're talking about her book, The Biggest Bluff. Let's talk about tells. Are tells real? And I should explain. So you hear about tells in poker, how there's something that a person does that's a giveaway, like a tick or a facial expression or a mannerism that says that they're bluffing or somehow reveals that they have a good hand or a bad hand. Are those real?
Yes, tells are real, but they're not real in the way that most people think that they're real.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the right answer when it comes not just to poker, but to life, because everyone has these kind of intuitive folk psychology ideas of, when somebody is lying. People blush. They do this. They do that. Everyone has their own little thing. Oh, yeah, I know when someone's lying. And they're wrong. And I say that with confidence because study after study after study has shown that people are basically no better than chance at actually being able to tell when someone's lying. We just think we're very, very good at it. The truth is there's, as one psychologist I talked to put it, there's no Pinocchio's nose of lying. It's not like there's something that happens to all people and voila, we know that this person is deceiving us. And so tells aren't real in that sense. But of course, we can glean a lot from behavior. And of course, people reveal certain things that they don't necessarily want to reveal. But we have to learn to think about it in a different way. And it's all about deviation from baseline. And what I mean from that is there's a way that people normally behave, their baseline of behavior. In a certain situation, this is what they normally do. This is what their posture is like. This is, how they do this. This is how they do that. What you need to be on the lookout for is when does that baseline change? When does something actually go differently? When does something shift in them? And even then, you don't know what it means. Right. You have the behavior, but you don't know whether it means that they're lying or whether it means that they're actually not lying. And so then you need feedback. You need to actually know what did this mean? You need to actually, if you're at a poker table, see their cards and see was this person bluffing or not so that you have more data. So it becomes very complicated.
Yeah.
And most people don't like to hear that. Instead, they want a very simple, this person blinked twice and their nose twitched. That means they were lying. It's not the way it works.
No,
instead, you really have to observe carefully.
Yeah, we think we're great judges of character. And you tell the story of this hand that you were playing against a guy who had a tank top on. He had these big biceps, shaved head, lots of tattoos. And immediately you mentioned in the book how you acted just based on his appearance. You got really lucky in that particular hand. You won it. But in some ways, you really shouldn't have. And the lesson you took from it was that you were reacting to a kind of implicit bias. So talk a little bit about that, how we form these judgments about people the longer we look at them.
Absolutely. I mean, this hand, I messed up on every single level. I'm a psychologist. I've studied implicit biases. Yeah. I know I'm not supposed to use this. And all of a sudden, this guy sits down. I mean, his biceps are like the size of houses. And I'm like, he is so aggressive. What a bully. I know how to stand up to bullies. I'm going to show him. And I ended up running a big bluff. And obviously, he had a really strong hand. And I just lucked out. I hit my miracle card. And he was supposed to knock me out of the tournament, but he didn't. And later, someone just looked at me and said, "Are you insane? This is one of the most conservative players. Like, he never bluffs. I was surprised he had pocket queens, which is one of the best hands in poker. I would have thought he had aces or maybe kings." And it was such a funny moment where I realized, wow, biases, just they're very real. And we always judge people from the moment we see them. And I had zero basis making a judgment like that about this person because I had not observed any behavior from him. I had zero basis for an actual judgment. Instead, I just used all of these subconscious cues, you know, big biceps, testosterone, tank top, tattoos. Yeah, this guy is aggressive. And no, I mean, that actually in a vacuum means absolutely nothing. And yet we all carry these biases around with us and we use them if we're not careful. And the funny thing is, I'm so aware of it, hyper aware of it all the time at the poker table, because again, poker, 98% male, 2% female. So what's the first thing that people notice about me? That I'm female. And so they have biases and they will play against me differently because I'm a woman. I know this and I was exploiting it. And here am I doing the exact same thing, just in reverse.
I want to ask you one more thing about tells, because there's this really fascinating study that you talk about. This psychology professor at Columbia, Michael Sleepian, who has studied, you know, basically whether people give away their intentions in the way they act, you know, their facial expression, stuff like that. And this made me think differently about tells. So talk about this one study that was really fascinating, that it wasn't players' facial expressions that were giving them away. It was their hands.
Yeah, he had this absolutely beautiful little way of looking at deception and whether we can tell when someone is bluffing. And he decided to show people clips from the World Series of Poker. He did it in three ways. So first, in totally unaltered footage. So you see the poker table, you see players sitting around it, and you see their bodies from the waist up, their hands, their faces. And he had people watch that. And then he had people watch a clip that was edited. So you just saw above the shoulders, so you saw their faces. And then he had a really interesting edit of a clip where you just saw below the shoulders. So you just saw kind of the arms and hands and that part of the video. And he asked people to just answer whether someone had a strong hand or not. And a lot of these people had never played poker. So all they needed to do was try to figure out, okay, does this person have a strong position or not? In the video, when it was totally unaltered, people were no better than chance, 50-50. And that's about what you'd expect, right? Normally, people are about 50-50 at telling whether someone's lying or not. When they were just looking at the face, they actually got worse. So suddenly they were worse than chance, which just is a very powerful illustration of the fact that we look at the wrong things and we look at the wrong cues when we look at faces. So it actually screws us up rather than makes us better. But he found something totally fascinating. And that's when people looked at hands, they suddenly became much better at being able to tell if someone was strong or not. And he then ended up doing a bunch of follow-up work on this. He found that, you know, the way that people handled cards and chips was a very good indication of their hand strength. Yeah. Are their cards good or are their cards not great? And that was really, really interesting. You know, the smoothness, the fluidity, the strength of the motion really, really matters. And it's true not just in poker. So there's been work that shows that if you look at someone's hands when they're playing Legos with you, you can predict whether they're going to help you or not. If you're a rugby player and you're looking at a rugby player's hands, even if you don't play rugby, just you can look at their hands and predict the direction of motion that they're going to be taking. So all of these really interesting things that come out from a body part that you wouldn't expect. And I think one of the reasons why hands end up being so powerful is that we don't expect it. You know, we know we're supposed to guard our faces. We are much less knowledgeable about what in the world we should be doing with our hands at any given moment. And we don't necessarily pay attention to them as much. And when you're not paying attention to something, that's when information might get revealed.
One of the really important parts of this story I wanted to ask you about is what you describe as getting your mind and your emotional landscape solid. That you can't really master poker or life without this self-knowledge and self-care and self-reflection. Say a little bit, if you would, with your work with Jared Tendler. He became your mental coach through this process.
Yeah.
And he helped you remove these triggers that made you behave emotionally rather than rationally?
Yeah, Jared is someone who approached me very early on. He'd heard about my project and reached out and said, hey, you know, I'm a mental coach. If you ever want to talk, let me know. And I said, ha, 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 I have a PhD in psychology. I do not need a mental game coach,
yeah.
which I find so funny. I mean, have I learned nothing?
Right.
So I dismissed him. And then it took me losing and experiencing some pretty low lows to say, maybe I did need a mental game coach after all. And I think everyone does. And he really, I mean, it's a very important lesson, right, in self-knowledge, that no one, you can never see yourself objectively. You just can't. We're subjective about ourselves. And oftentimes you need some external help. You need someone from the outside who's able to look at you and help you identify things that you don't necessarily see for yourself. And so I ended up working for some time with Jared, and he was immensely helpful in bringing my mental game on level with my strategic game. And don't underestimate the mental game. I mean, that's your ability to perform under pressure. That's your ability to figure out what's going on in your mind. That's your ability to distill your emotions and to cool those emotions down and to control them and to eliminate them from your decision process so that you can make more rational choices, so that you can act based on the probabilities and not based on what you're feeling at the moment and the fact that that guy just really, really, really pissed you off.
Yeah. Well, I love the way you mentioned how just being aware of the cause of our moods makes such a big difference. And there was this study about mood as information and the weather that I wanted you to say something about.
So there's a wonderful term in psychology called mood as information, and it was coined by Nisbet and Wilson in this famous study where they called people. The people that they called were in different zip codes, and the zip codes were chosen specifically based on the cloud cover at the moment of the phone call during that particular time of day. And they asked people about their life satisfaction. And it turns out that people who were in places with more sun reported higher life satisfaction than people in cloudy areas. But then they did something really interesting. They said, oh, you know, how's the weather there? And when they asked about the weather, the effect completely disappeared. All of a sudden, the life satisfaction ratings were equal. And so they realized that people were using their mood, how they were feeling, you know, because it was sunny or cloudy, as information about their general life satisfaction. But all it took was to draw their attention to the actual cause of the mood, the weather, and they were then able to eliminate that as one of the inputs into their answer, which is really interesting. It means that we're using incidental things that don't actually matter, incidental emotions, incidental moods. We're using them in our decision calculus all the time without realizing it, just because it affects how we're feeling and, you know, what we're thinking at any given point in time. But all we need to do is become aware of that, and then we can make much better decisions that will eliminate the emotions that have nothing to do with it. It's not saying that, you know, emotions bad, don't feel emotions. It's saying, yeah, everyone's going to experience emotions and moods, and you're going to, you know, sometimes you're hungry, sometimes you're angry, sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad. I'm singing a song here, I think. And that's fine. As long as you're then able to say, okay, why am I feeling this? And does it actually have to do anything with the decision that I'm about to make? And if the answer is no, then I need to discount it and I need to make the decision anyway. And that's so important. And that's something that I think we should all get into the habit of doing. How am I feeling? Check in with yourself. Why am I feeling this way? Okay, 9 times out of 10, the why is going to have nothing to do with the decision I'm about to make. So let me move that emotion aside and make the decision without it.
You come to this really interesting place at the end of all of this, and that is, as you put it in the book, that you can't control what will happen. So it makes no sense to try and guess at it. You say chance is just chance. It's neither good nor bad nor personal. So what are you saying there, that we have to provide our own meaning, I guess?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying. And that we have to, I think, focus on the things that we can control, because there's so many of them. You know, you're never going to be able to affect the outcome. You are never going to be able to affect what actually happens. But you can put yourself in a position to be on the favorable side of the distribution. You can put yourself in a position to get lucky. And then you might not get lucky. You might still get unlucky, because skill is incredibly important and you need skill. But you also have to get lucky at the end of the day. And we have to be okay with that and just try to make the most of our skill, try to make the most of our agency and to reclaim it everywhere we can, and put ourselves in a position to get lucky over and over and over, knowing that it won't always work out. But if we dwell on that, then we're using our precious emotional resources on something that we can't change and something that we had no control over. And so all it's going to do is drag us down. Instead, why don't we focus on the things that are actually within us to change and work on getting those as polished as possible so that next time, maybe we will get lucky.
Maria Konnikova, her book is The Biggest Bluff: How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.